This is the podcast that we ask our guests from in front and behind the camera, how did they get their foot in the door? What was the key to unlocking their success? What's their story?
Our guest today is an Oscar winner. He's a writer, director, and producer from sweeping epics Legends of the Fall and Glory, the generation-defining 30-something, Love and Other Drugs, Blood Diamond, and The Last Samurai, and many, many, many more. His new memoir, Hits, Flops, and Other Illusions, recounts his battle with Harvey Weinstein to get Shakespeare in Love made, why Tom Cruise makes getting a movie made easy, and how his first time on set happened to be with Woody Allen. We chat about all of this, and of course, we get to hear his most embarrassing moment that didn't make it into the book. Our guest today is Edward Zwick.
Hey, how's it going, Edward? Are you having a good day?
So far, yeah, it's still a bit early. It could all go wrong still.
Well, thanks for taking the time, man. I really appreciate it. I mean, you must be doing all kinds of interviews and stuff. So, thanks for taking the time, man.
Sure. I mean, this is what one does when you have something that you're proud of and you want to get it out there. And there isn't a lot of money, frankly, to market books, as you probably know. Mm-hmm. And so it's all about putting yourself, in these
put yourself out there. I have to say, I really enjoyed the book, and I'm dyslexic, so that's saying something. It's a struggle for me to commit and finish an entire book, but I was drawn in, I was sucked in, and there were so many surprises in there. I didn't, I'm very familiar with your career. I'm a big fan of your films, and the series that you've done as well. But reading the book, there were so many moments in there I just wasn't expecting. And it felt like a very honest betrayal. Was there ever a point where you were kind of umming and ahhing about any of the things you put in there? Were you kind of, I mean, it's pretty, some of it's pretty honest.
I would say all the time. I think I had to make a determination, a personal commitment, that I wanted to try to search for authenticity. And that meant, about if I was going to do it about other people, then I'd have to do it about myself. And it was harder at first. It got easier. I've spent a career writing things for that are personal, that go in the mouths of very attractive men and women, over there under the lights, and I'm safely hidden behind the camera. And then to sort of dive into the first person is a very different, very vulnerable experience. And on the other hand, there was something liberating about it, because it wasn't about making a film that was going to be previewed for an audience. It wasn't going to be a conversation with the studio. It was going to be about what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And that was fun, I have to say. And by the way, I also felt that it was a challenge trying to find a different voice, a writerly, more, a prose voice, which was different, and try to be entertaining in that too. So that was also an agenda.
It must have been a bit odd to, obviously all the scripts you've written, to then suddenly be almost writing the script of your life. It's a very, as you say, a very different thing to go from scripts to sort of, writing a biography. Did that take a minute to kind of click in your head? Was it kind of a challenge?
Yeah, I also think that somebody once said that autobiography is the highest form of fiction. So in some regard, it was also deciding on, not just who I was, but how I would portray myself. Mm. And that's a bit of a hall of mirrors, as you can imagine. As I thought more about it, or as I wrote more about it, or as I've read other, autobiographies, memoirs, that I think there is something that appealed to me, that to reveal, to just to realize and to reveal often how much I was taking the piss out of myself. Mm. Much I was not, I was not telling the joke, I was the joke, and that was fun.
Yeah, no, I that's sometimes a rare thing as well. When you read a book about someone's life, it feels like they're kind of pumping themselves up, but I just, as I said before, it felt like a very honest betrayal and very revealing. for the reader, for sure.
And, I just didn't want to be, and then I did this, and then I did that. And it's like, no, I mean, yes, that all comes across anyway. It's
Yeah.
all in the DNA of what you're doing. And so why not, try to find a different attack, different angle?
And to quote, I mean, to quote your book, because there is a point where you say that, when people are commenting on your work and saying they're a big fan, and it can sometimes be a bittersweet feeling. But I'm going to do it anyway. I'm a huge, huge
No,
fan.
yeah, don't hesitate. It's fine. I
I
can take it.
am a huge fan, and particularly, I mean, The Last Samurai was something when I was growing up, that was a film that it was actually one of the I myself am an actor. And that was the one of the films when I was growing up. It came at a point where I was very influenced by it. So I was watching that, and I remember watching Tom Cruise's performance in that. Particularly a moment, which maybe looking back now, maybe it was just that moment because I was a kid. But the moment when Tom Cruise is knelt down, and he's there, and he's so emotional, and he looks up, and he just has one single tear come down his cheek. And I remember being a kid, just being like, blowing my mind, and it was, I remember it was a real moment for me. I was like, I want to do that. I want to be an actor like Tom Cruise.
Wow. Well, it was, by the way, I mean, people obviously think of Tom in terms of all of these extraordinary, big, huge things that he's done. But, you have to look at, the Jerry Maguire and Paul Thomas Anderson movie and Born on the 4th of July. I mean, he's the real deal. I know that image that you're describing, the other thing I look at it is the veins in his forehead. Literally so pulsing almost in a way as to be upsetting. Like, is he going to stroke out at this moment because he's such intensity? And I know the moment you're describing. And he found that intensity throughout the movie, and I think helped enable a lot of others around him to go there. When you talk about acting in that movie, Ken Watanabe's performance is just huge. It's really a combination of great joy and humor and sort of majesty. And that's Tom giving the stage to someone as well, understanding that somebody else's performance is only going to make his better.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, it's a masterful film in so many ways, and I mean, at the time, it felt like a real kind of change of pace for Tom Cruise as well. I remember thinking, not only his appearance, but he was like it sounds like a strange thing to say, because he was probably, I don't know how old he was when he did the film, but it felt like a really adult film and a really adult role. For me, as a child watching it, I was like, I shouldn't be watching this, but I absolutely loved it. I mean, we're going to talk about obviously a lot of things that are mentioned in your book that, I don't want to spoil any of the stories that are in your book, because obviously we want people to read it. But in terms of working with someone like Tom Cruise, you've worked with some of the very best, but Tom Cruise is, he's still, and probably maybe the only movie star left. Working with someone like that, and getting them to come on board, I remember you saying in the book that, the minute Tom Cruise came on board, it was suddenly like, oh, it's happening. Everything is go. What was that
Yeah.
experience like?
Well, I mean, I've had to fight tooth and nail to get every movie made that I've been managed to make, and it's often a kind of siege mentality. And this wasn't. It was literally okay. They understood the concept. They saw his participation at the center of it as being, heroic, and they also knew that it would have a very particular kind of action in it. And somehow those three things lined up is for them to say, okay, well, what do you need? I said, what do you mean, what do I need? They said, well, I mean, you probably have to go to Japan now for a while and meet people and scout. And you, I think, well, go get in the helicopter in New Zealand and see where the best location might be. And maybe we'll just build that Tokyo Street here on the New York lot. And I'm, these things are like coming at me thick and fast. And even so, and this is the funny part always, even so, we exceeded what they wanted us to do. I mean, meaning we then have to fight about money because, the worst thing you can do is give a filmmaker money because it means he wants that and $10 more. And so your appetite overreaches a bit.
Fabulous. Okay. It's a dance piece.
It's an audience. It's a performance.
That's fun. That's pretty good. Next, you're going into the dance. Okay. Please. Take a breath.
Same thing.
I want to do it at speed. Right. 48. 48 frames. Cool. Take a breath. We'll do it again.
Speed.
You know, five more times.
Did a great job today. Absolutely outstanding. I have never in my entire career seen anything like this. If you see it on film, you're going to be very proud of yourselves because it is very, very exciting. So domo, domo, arigato. Have a great weekend.
All right, thank you.
But it was a great experience in that regard too, because, you know, I remember with Nyla Dixon going, sitting down with the emperor's costumer in his little studio, where he would take out bolts of cloth that had been part of the Dowager Empress's ward trousseau in the 19th century, and, you know, or weapons people, or, you know, this amazing just contributors, and we were making a movie very important to this group of people about something that was a period of their lives, of their time, of their country. And we were able to really, you know, dig into it in a way that was really fun.
Mm. Well, that's the crazy thing about some of the projects you've done, and not only directing, but the ones you've written, they're so different.
Yeah.
And it feels like every time you do a project, it feels like you want to kind of try something new or do something. I mean, from Love and Other Drugs to, yeah, you know, Blood Diamond, you don't really... Yeah. Get any different, more different than that. Do you like writing over one other thing? Is there sort of a favorite genre that you go for?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, it's always felt for me that making a movie for 2 years was like going to get another graduate degree in something. And whether that was in history or whether it was in politics or whether it was in some psychological study. I'm easily bored, and I like to be a little bit scared. I think that keeps me, you know, awake. And the idea of trying different things is, in some sense, it may be harder actually for one's career, because people are often more comforted when you are predictable. Mm. They know what they're going to get and what you're going to do. And there's some anxiety when you're talking about things that might be a little bit off center for what they expect. But somehow I've been able to keep that going. And one reason is that a good number of them have made money for the studios, and they are pleased enough to then say, oh, fuck, let's let them try it again.
Mm-mm. Let him go wild. See what he comes up with next.
Well, I wouldn't say wild, but let him keep him on a leash if we can.
Keep him under control. And to go back to, you know, right at the start where you got the bug for filmmaking. I mean, obviously, I'm going to say, am I correct in saying this? But I mean, it's in the book. But one of your first tastes of being on set was with Woody Allen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was young. I was 21.
Wow.
I was coincident. I was living in France. I was on a fellowship, and I was observing experimental theater directors in Paris. There, Peter Brook was at the Bouffe du Nord, and Ariane Nouchkine was at the Théâtre du Soleil, and I thought that was going to be my course. I'd been a theater kid in college, and in, you know, summer stock and all of that. And I did that for a bit, but what I found myself doing was just going to the movies. Mm. Just Paris is the best place to go to movies, because there are all those revival houses that, you know, and there's also the Cinémathèque, which at the time was, the American dollar was very strong, so that maybe 4 francs was the equivalent of a dollar, or maybe $1.20. Wow. And for that, you could see 3 movies. You could see a six o'clock, an 8 o'clock, and a 10 o'clock. And one night it would be Fellini, and the next night would be Kurosawa, and the next night would be John Ford. And it was just a deliriously fun time. And so when I coincidentally met Woody Allen and asked if I could just come by the set to observe.
That's mad.
I mean, the kind of thing I would never do now, and that you only do when you're 21 and you're full of yourself and you don't know any better. And I did. And he was so gracious, and he invited me. And then because I spoke French, he was able to give me, some work on the movie. And then I got to know him better. And I would, he allowed me to ask stupid questions. But he was also a writer who loved film, obviously loved film, but surrounded himself with hugely gifted people who could help translate that vision. Mm. And he didn't necessarily have to know about lenses or have to know about different kind of exposure, but he could articulate what he wanted. Mm. And that, that was when the penny dropped. And I thought, okay, well, maybe instead of going back to New York and trying to scrabble my way into the theater, then maybe I would just go to California like everybody else in history who's gone there to try to reinvent themselves in their own image. And I did.
Wow. It's mad, isn't it? It's I feel like moments of sliding doors of moments like where you just think, well, anything could have changed,
You bet. Oh, my God.
The whole line of things.
You bet. And that is, but then again, the same is true. I mean, I'm now married for a long time. And if I'd not gone in that store at that moment and met her, what would have happened? I mean, I think as you examine your life, it's actually full of those moments.
Yeah.
I think that intentionality is important because it gives us comfort, but I'm not sure we really have control the kind that we think we have.
100%. It's terrifying. Check out the Patreon at patreon.com/lifeandfilm. Where you'll get episodes early and uncut, amongst other treats. And don't forget to follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If you enjoy this episode, please leave us a positive rating. Add us on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok at Life in Film Pod, and find our video episodes on YouTube by searching Elliot James Langridge Life in Film. Essentially, please like and subscribe everything. It makes a huge difference. Thank you. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Do you work in the film industry? Are you freelance? Or perhaps you have a 9-to-5? No matter what you do, mental health affects us all. I struggled early on in my career with the uncertainty of if and when I would ever work again, struggling to pay my bills, or simply with anxiety. Don't know about you, but being an actor, it's very important for me to maintain structure in the down times, and I found not only exercise, but talking to someone, for me, was a game changer. And so Life in Film has partnered with BetterHelp to provide you with access to the largest online therapy service in the world. And it can all be done from the comfort of your own home, from a phone, tablet, or laptop. No commute, cutting down travel costs, and most importantly, it's affordable. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. If you need someone to talk to and you're thinking of giving therapy a go, BetterHelp is a great option. And being a listener of the podcast, you get 10% off. That's 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/lifeandfilm. That's betterhelp.com/lifeandfilm. And back to the show. In terms of, we have a lot of people that listen to this podcast that are up and coming filmmakers, people that look up to people like you and want to be, doing the movies you've done. Would you dare to give advice to those people that are starting out?
Well, without trying to sound self-serving, I would say read the damn book, because that was the agenda. I mean, if I had a goal, it's that this book is written for a young filmmaker. I mean, it's written for those who know the movies and are older and take an appreciation to see the inside sports, the inside look at behind the camera and the curtain and all that stuff. And that dish is great. I don't depreciate it. But really, to me, the attempt was to talk about the process and the experience and the emotional aspects of it. And not just where to put the camera, although there's certainly a lot of that, and there's how to do this or that, but really about what it takes to create a career, what it takes to deal with the buffeting winds that knock you down? How do you get up? You know, about those relationships that endure, and how are they created? And I mean, to me, there's an agenda also having to do with a certain kind of humanist narrative tradition of American film, which is a little bit of disrepair. Let's just, you know, acknowledge that in terms of grown up films, there are fewer of them. They exist in streamers. I understand that. But again, often at a different scale and often with less regularity. Mm. There's a moment in the book when I quote, I just make a list of the movies that I saw when I was, you know, 25. And it's just
crazy.
God, what those movies were and what we just saw one week after the next and without ever any hope of seeing them again. Mm. There was no tape. There was no DVD. There was nothing there. You just had this deep ephemeral experience. And if sometimes you went back or you stayed up all night talking to your friends and you know, they were a very seminal part of the culture in a way that they aren't quite now.
Well, that's, I mean, yeah, the industry has obviously changed hugely, but to, not to go back to The Last Samurai, but films like that, I can't imagine. I don't know what the budget was on it, but I'm presuming it was pretty large. And I can't imagine a film like that, of that scale, being made about something like that now. It feels like, I don't know, it feels like things have changed so much.
It's hard to imagine it. Look, every now and then, a director gets an opportunity. You know, you saw what Chris was able to do with Oppenheimer, and, you know, and,
yeah, sure.
And every now and then, of course, you get to see that. But it's rare. Mm. And it's often about a director who's reached a moment where they have a certain amount of personal capital that they can expend, and they do, and they're given the right to do a thing, and they've earned it. And that happened to me as well in that regard.
Mm-mm. And I just find it mind blowing. One of the aspects of the book that really surprised me was I thought it was going to get to a point where, you know, and then we just made this film and it was great and we did this and this and this. It was a build up. But it felt like every project that you talk about was full of delays, full of struggle. It was never as easy as you presume, you know, because we've seen the finished product. We've seen the films and we know that they're great. But it's persuading people before they know what it's going to be to actually put the money into these things. And it just blew my mind. A particular story that comes to mind is, you know, producing Shakespeare in Love, and that process of, you know, it almost happening, then it happening, and then the female actress being replaced. And I use an app to listen to books. And so I was listening to this and I had to rewind it because I was like,
wait, time out here. Is that my reading of it that you've heard?
No. So I use an app called Natural Reader. So
it's like an AI type of reading.
Yeah. So if I get sent a book or sent a script or anything like that, it reads it to me. Have you done an audio version of the book?
I have. I've not spoken to anybody. I'm terrified as to how it came out. I've not spoken to anybody who's heard it.
Oh, I wish I'd had a copy of that. That sounds a lot better because mine's very robotic when I listen to it.
Sure.
but it just blew my mind, like the process of a film like Shakespeare in Love, which obviously won the Oscar for best film and it's huge success, but yet the journey to getting that film made was fraught with all kinds of mad stories. It doesn't get any easier.
I don't know where to begin. you know, it's, you know, just when you think it's safe to go back in the water, having gone through what I went through, and then there waiting around the corner is Harvey Weinstein, you know, and it just never stops. And that will continue to be true, I'm convinced, with things that are ambitious and things that are not an IP or a superhero. But I even suspect, I've not ever been in that Marvel universe, but I'm sure, and maybe even right now, particularly where there's some thoughts that the bloom might be off the rose and there might be a little bit of gnashing of teeth. They're like, well, what do we do? And so some poor director and some screenwriter is getting the full brunt of that anxiety and trying to serve themselves and to serve their masters.
Mm-hmm. Do you have, I mean, because you've obviously done, you know, huge projects, smaller projects, TV, you've done a bit of everything, and obviously writing, producing, directing. Do you have, if you could just pick out a perfect project, is writing a primal thing, or is the directing what you? I mean, they're all so different, aren't they? But is there one that you enjoy more than the other? I'm trying to say.
I think that when I'm writing, I want to be directing, and when I'm directing, I want to be writing.
Rose tinted. You're just looking back, thinking, "Well, the writing process was really nice and quiet." And then you're on set as a
Yeah,
director, thinking,
and very lonely, and
"Yeah."
very alienating, and demanding in a particular way. And the directing part of it is very, very just. It's mind-bending in terms of the amount of decisions you have to make, and the amount of information that's coming at you, and the stress and the struggle of trying to actually figure out how to do a thing that you've written on paper but doesn't have a practical application in the world, and how do you reconcile those things? So it's they are as different as can be. As a writer, if you're a really good writer, you have to anticipate what that actor's issues are going to be. You have to go through his process of motivation and obstacle and action. And the same thing you should be doing for the director, because that's going to actually be the difference, rather than having to reinterpret something that somebody has done without any reality principle.
I mean, the level of stress really came across. I was stressed, stressed reading it, but it sounds like it. I mean, with the film industry, it's a lot of give, but you also get a lot back, and it's very rewarding in a way that, a lot of jobs aren't. But I guess it's kind of taking the good and taking on the bad when it comes.
Yeah, somebody once said that directing is no fun, but there's great joy in having directed.
Yeah, looking back on it, it's great. I would have asked you before I read the book, I would have asked, do you have a favorite film that you've made? But then I know that in the book you obviously say my favorite film that I've made is the one that I haven't made yet. I mean, I'm paraphrasing there, obviously. I've probably got that slightly
Yeah,
wrong,
and
but
yeah, that's right. And I have two children. You know, am I to make a Sophie's Choice about them? I have a dog and a cat, and do I favor one? You just it's what would you say? Horses for courses, right? Isn't that the phrase?
Yeah, you can't really. I mean, some people might, if they have a cat and a dog, I'm not going to say with the kids, but with a cat and a dog, you might have a favorite, but you might just
Well, in
not
fact, I
voice
do.
it.
I was just being politically correct there, but not about
Yeah,
my
no, totally fair enough. But was
people.
there a
I'm actually convinced that dogs are in fact so companionable, and that cats, if they were larger, would just eat you.
Yeah, oh, 100%. Yeah, if you turned up as a mouse, the cat
Exactly.
wouldn't think twice. You'd be gone. I'm looking at my cat right now. He's eyeing me up as if I were a mouse, he'd be going for me. But in terms of, you've had 40 plus years. I don't want to age you, but 40 plus
Thank
years
you. Yeah.
in the industry. I mean, it's obviously changed a huge amount. But in terms of, Trial by Fire, a film I really, really enjoyed of yours. Looking at that film and then the way you say you made one of your first movies, has the process changed a lot in the physical form of directing? Has that changed?
No. I mean, yeah, I mean, yes, in terms of, digital technologies have allowed you to do certain things faster. Amount of time it takes to light something, the sensitivity of lenses and all of that, the editing process, because of what's happened in terms of those editing programs, is more economical. But what's changed most has to do with, I think, a very odd kind of studio mentality that has affected every decision in every institution. There are four people listening to the pitch, and then it has to be kicked upstairs, and they have a process by which the script has to then be vetted, and then there has to be a process by which they have to figure out. I mean, some of it's all very efficient, but the degree of trust in an individual artist and his ability to do something often seems a little bit depreciating because they want what you do, but they want to do it, or they want you to know that there's a kind of control that exists there, that they're setting guardrails, and that's a little bit correct, because some directors, you know, were more childlike and have been, you know, extravagant. But it also just doesn't allow for that process of improvisation and creativity that happens as the process goes on. They want to see everything preordained. They want to know all the episodes of a show and the arcs of the characters. They wanted the absolute finished script at the early point so as to decide and with their notes. And that's taking away something in the process. Imagine someone trying to do that to Hal Ashby. Wouldn't have happened. Imagine someone trying to do that with, with Francis Coppola. It just wouldn't have happened in that way. And so there's a little bit of rue about that, about the state of that.
I'm not saying that we're living in a time where the movies aren't great, because there are great movies and there are great projects that come out. But I do find myself sometimes when I'm, you know, looking for a movie at home, if I'm on Netflix or whatever, I tend to watch older films. I go back and I revisit things that I've seen. Maybe it's a nostalgia thing. Maybe it's a, you know, you just know what you're going to get. But I do yearn for that period of film, like the 1970s, 1980s, the 90s, the two, like anything. I mean, the last 10 years, I feel like film has changed quite a bit. And maybe it is because of the streaming platforms. I don't know what it is, but
it's different to look at a movie on your computer. It's different to be a young artist thinking about to make a movie that is, you've learned about filmmaking on your computer. It's different to be a young artist trying to create a story that exists in chapters rather than in some unity of action or of plot or emotional movement. And that's got to be different. And also to have had the experience of looking at film where you can stop and look at your emails, where you can stop and go to the refrigerator, where you can see the rest tomorrow night or see it in bits. It's a different medium.
And to go back to the book, is there a moment, can you pinpoint a moment in your career that was the sort of the hardest moment? Was there a point where you thought, maybe this isn't for me, maybe I'm not cut out for this?
Every time
you do a film.
Every time. I mean, there's inevitably that day when it's 4:30 in the morning and you haven't slept and you're anxious about the next day and you're fighting a cold and you're having a fight with your DP or there's an actor that's being his little baby bitch or and you just when that alarm goes off, you just want to say, oh, please, can I just have one day without this? And I think that happened just as much in the first couple as they have in the last few. It just happens.
And then I guess when the job ends, then you're looking back at it with rose-tinted glasses, like, oh, it'd be great to be back on set.
because you know, films are they're deconstructed, and they're broken up into these little discrete bits that you do a bit at a time, and you lose your faith in the vision, or you lose the excitement of seeing things coming together. But then, blissfully, you know, as you see things put together and all of a sudden they work again, you can be reinvigorated. And that's, by the way, I've had the same editor for all my entire career. And, you know, those moments when he says, listen, I want you to come by the cutting room, I just want you to see something, he looks like you could use a little bit of a pick-me-up. And I can sit there and look at it, and it's like, oh, okay. Well, that gives me some heart for tomorrow.
That's amazing to have a collaboration like that where you know each other so well that you can be really honest with each other. And obviously you mentioned in the book there's a few people that you've written with along the way that are, still with you now. And those collaborations, are they must be very important to you when you're moving on and starting a new project.
One reason is you develop a shorthand and a fondness for people, and you've managed to weed out those who are either disruptive or less gifted, or for whatever reasons of personal taste. And as you begin to surround yourself with people like that, it becomes, an additional layer of enjoyment.
It's amazing. Some of the projects you've done, it just blows my mind. And it's a real honor to talk to you and to chat to you about all these things. And I want to lower the tone. Most embarrassing moments, yeah.
I have,
I mean, there's
I have,
quite a few in the book, to be honest,
but I have actually. I actually the other day I was thinking. And there was one that occurred to me that I didn't put in the book, which I can tell you, which is
Oh,
pretty
right. Oh, an exclusive.
well. When you first make a movie, you then take it out and you preview it, which is to say, you show it in a sort of a rough cutter, but some polish to an audience that has never seen it, doesn't know what they're going to see. And for some reason, they decided this is a movie. This is my first movie. It was about last night, and they took us to a suburb of New York City or New Jersey, and you're very nervous, and you sit down, and the credits roll, and the first reel goes, and it seems to be okay. And the second reel comes out, and the projectionist has switched the reels. He is now projecting the fourth reel after the first reel. And you can see the audience kind of saying, "Huh? What the fuck?" And you're going crazy, and I just literally race out of the theater and find the stairs and run up to the projection booth, and I go in there screaming, "What the fuck are you doing, you mother, all of that." And he's terrified. The crazy man has run in here, and I explained to him what's going on. He goes, "Oh my God, oh my God." He shuts down the film, finds the correct reel. Now, meantime, the audience
Oh,
is getting restless, puts the next reel up, but in his haste, he has banged the projector. So when he turns the projector on, it's now shooting down into the audience.
no.
Yes. And at this point, I mean, on the verge of tears. And then, they finally get through it. And somebody from the studio says, "Well, that didn't play quite well as we thought." And he says, "Fuck you, motherfucker. What are you talking about? That wasn't the movie. What is this experience that they had? Because it wasn't the movie." And I literally, I just wanted to murder this guy, and he was just a woebegone projectionist. I really wanted to murder this at that point. One of the people from the studio who said, "Well, I can see some things that we have to deal with in terms of pace." So, anyway,
I
that's.
actually I hadn't seen that movie, and I watched it. I watched it last week, and I love those kind of films. They're like such a real, it's like a real time warp. I love the 1980s kind of Elmo's Fire and Breakfast Club and all those kind of movies. And I really enjoyed it, and it was great because I was like, I've been a fan of a lot of your work, and that kind of I was looking into the ones I hadn't seen. So I really enjoyed kind of exploring and finding all these other projects that I hadn't seen along the way, but. Thank you so much, and thank you for letting me read your book early. I'll be ordering a copy for my dad for his birthday because I know he'll love it.
That's what I want to hear. That's the whole point. I'm really, I have hopes, and I have hopes that these kind of conversations lead to people actually wanting to read it. So thank you.
No, it's nice. It's I really really enjoyed it, and being like a real cinephile, I love movies. So this was like a really nice insight, and yeah, I really enjoyed it, man.
Good. Well, again, thank you.
Thank you very much. Take
All
care
right.
and all the best with the book.
Thanks. Cheers.
Cheers, man. Bye.
Thank you to our guest, Edward. Thank you to IDPR. And as always, thank you to our sponsor, BetterHelp. Edward's memoir, Hits, Flops, and Other Illusions, is out now.